Yeah, hello, my name is Bettina Althoff and I will be the guide, and we'll go through the practice, the apartment of Sigmund Freud at Berggasse 19.
Well, here I am in Vienna and I'm looking up at a very special house indeed. And there's a big sign here in massive red letters and it says Freud. Imagine if your mind was a house, rather like the one I'm standing in front of here in Vienna, with different rooms for different mental functions. Sigmund Freud made the comparison in 1917 in one of his famous public lectures at the University of Vienna.
We will compare the system of the unconscious to a large antechamber in which the psychic impulses rub elbows with one another as separate beings. There opens out of this antechamber another, a smaller room, a sort of parlor, which consciousness occupies. But on the threshold between the two rooms, there stands a watchman. He passes on the individual psychic impulses, senses them, and will not let them into the parlor if they do not meet with his approval. These impulses in the antechamber of the unconscious cannot be seen by the conscious, which is in the other room. Therefore, for the time being, they must remain unconscious. When they have succeeded in pressing forward to the threshold and have been sent back by the watchman, then they are unsuitable for consciousness, and we call them suppressed.
The striking metaphor of the mind as a house. But I'm curious then about what Sigmund Freud's house tells us about his mind. Today we're at Berggasse number 19. This was Sigmund Freud's home and office from 1891 for nearly 50 years before he left Vienna for London in 1938 to escape the Nazis, just a year before his death from cancer at age 83. It was where he lived with his wife Martha and raised their six children. This is where he wrote famous works like The Interpretation of Dreams and The Psychopathology of Everyday Life, where he started the notorious Wednesday Psychological Society's meetings, a motley gathering of intellectuals like Carl Jung and Alfred Adler, and which was to become the seeds of the Vienna Psychoanalytic Society. His youngest daughter, Anna Freud, who also became a famous psychoanalyst in her father's footsteps, set up her first consulting rooms here too. And indeed, it was Anna who, in the end, helped launch this Viennese museum back in 1971, then nearly 80 herself. But Freud, as with most of his family, including his famous artist grandson, Lucian Freud, who died last year, they never came back.
The circumstances here became very dangerous in the 1930s, as you know, and he didn't want to go. But after the annexation, which took place in March 1938, the Nazis came and took all the money and also the youngest daughter, Anna. And then he realized, well, how dangerous. Yeah.
Today, with museum guide Bettina Althoff, we're sleuthing for really more intimate impressions of Sigmund Freud rather than a definitive history. Did he like Vienna? Because I've heard mixed reports. I keep hearing that he really pined for his old home in, is it Freiburg or Freiburg?
He was born in Freiberg. Now it is called Pschibor. Both is right. Yeah, he liked and even loved it, but at the same time, he hated it. It wasn't so easy for him to live here, to start a career as scientist. He was a Jew, always remained a Jew, though never practicing. So it wasn't so easy for him and his family.
And I guess his ideas weren't always popular. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, exactly, yes. In the beginning, you know, he was more or less an outcast. He was ignored or very often offended because he touched on taboos like sexuality and even worse, sexuality and childhood. So nobody wanted to work with him. But he wanted to discuss his theories with friends and colleagues. And that's why he started his famous Wednesday Evening Society.
Well, we'll come to that. Let's just walk in away from the road. And it's also getting rather chilly out here. We're heading into the front door of the museum now. It's a long avenue and we're just turning up the right here, up a big staircase.
A bed of neuroses, of tossing and turning, of obsessive yearning.
What do you think it is about Sigmund Freud that still attracts that incredible curiosity, even from people who don't really know his theories, they just have an impression of him?
Yeah. It's an interesting question, but I think he wanted to... He wanted to find out what human beings are, in fact. Even now, we are interested in all these kind of questions. And with him started so many different directions of psychoanalysis. So maybe back to the roots, yeah, when people come here.
Don't belong, life is just a couch of confession, a constant depression, a crib of regression.
And original are the doors, the windows, window frames, and also these stucco ornaments on the ceiling. When he had to leave, he was fortunate because he was able to take everything with him, all the furniture. The result of that is that the couch is no longer here.
It's in London, isn't it?
Yeah, right, yeah.
He took his whole collection of art and archaeological artefacts and antiques too, which was pretty impressive. In fact, I have read that he started to take them all on holidays with him every year as well. He'd pack them up and take them away to a holiday house, which I thought was fairly ambitious. He had thousands of pieces.
Yeah, 3,000 in fact. And he started collecting antiquities in the late 1890s, and it was very modern at that time, a real hype. And he also felt like an archaeologist, someone who has to dig out all the reasons for the disturbances and so on. And
Much was made for that, wasn't it, that he was an archaeologist of the mind.
Right.
And yet he had this obsession with antiquities and archaeological digs and collections and things, didn't he?
He adored them. But in his family, he was alone. His wife Martha, she didn't like them at all. His dirty old gods, how he used to call them.
He did, didn't he?
Yeah.
Dirty old gods.
Yeah. So everything was in his practice. It was very crowded there. And the visitors were astonished because it was a little bit spooky there.
One of his famous patients, which he named the Wolfman because he was a patient who'd had a dream of, I think, a tree full of white wolves or something.
That's right, yes.
Described his consulting rooms as more like an archaeologist's office. And, you know, Freud might not have been looking at him, at the patients, but all these figurine heads were certainly staring
at
them.
We're not alone.
They were in the company of many.
We have a portrait of the Wolfman and also a landscape he did. Very famous and very precious.
We're in the space of the private apartment, so tell me about his life in here. Did he have all of his six children in this apartment?
They had six children in 8 years, so a lot of work for his wife Martha. Three girls, three boys, and they used to have lunch together punctually at 1 o'clock here in this room, more or less, because behind this door was the kitchen.
It's got a stone floor. Walking into a space, there's a room full of lots of books over there. I'm intrigued by that.
And now it's also the entrance to the research library.
Oh, shall we head in there?
Yeah.
Okay, let's do that. So we're walking into Freud's private living room, a long room with the similar parquetry floors. And at the end of the room, indeed, is a bust of Sigmund Freud himself, looking rather pensive, I think.
He used to look like that, yeah.
And sort of earnest and very reflective, I think, yeah.
So I think that's Freud, but here in these rooms where he spent most part of his life, so 50 years, you feel also the private man. Yeah, he was also a father, a husband, And he adored his children, but only the youngest, Anna, of course you know her, she followed the footprints of her father. She was a teacher, but very interested in her father's theories, so she was analyzed by her own father. Well, would be impossible nowadays.
It's slightly questionable.
I dare say not the best way to get rid of family ties, but no. It happened like that. And Anna, she opened her practice here in this apartment in 1923.
So let's come back into the library. Who comes here now? Who uses this space and the collections that you have here? And just looking at the collections, you've got, well, probably all of his work and many other scholars' work on Freud.
In different languages, and we have about 35,000, 38,000 volumes.
Right. Of so the we've library. Got the gender section here, I think. Presentations of gender, deceptive distinctions. What else? Between feminism and psychoanalysis. Yes, women have certainly taken him on over the years.
I think you have to see what was not right, and Freud and women, for example.
He did think that most women suffered from penis envy, so we read him differently today.
And so many students, they come here, but teachers, scientists as well. Everybody interested in psychoanalysis or philosophy or whatever. Yeah,
It is true. Okay, now we're heading into another space.
It's the bedroom of Sigmund and Martha. It's not part of the museum.
The bedroom?
Yeah. There's something special.
Yes, it's something about bedrooms, isn't it? I see a book up here called Marie Bonaparte. Yeah. And she was one of his patients, but she became a very, very dear friend. I gather that
that's right.
I think she helped get him out of Vienna when the Nazis came.
She came from France to be analysed by Sigmund Freud.
Was she a Greek princess, is that right?
Yes, she was the great-grandniece of Napoleon and married with Prince George from Denmark and Greece. Yeah. So not only she became a psychoanalyst, she also became a very close friend of the family, especially of Anna Freud. And when the Nazis came here and took Anna for negotiations, she came back and they wanted to emigrate. It was due to Marie Bonaparte that it was possible. And they had to pay the so-called Reichsfluchtsteuer, a tax for persons fleeing the Reich, a sum of more than 32,000 Reichsmark, nowadays a sum of more than 100,000 euros.
Oh my God.
He couldn't pay that sum. The Nazis had taken his money, blocked accounts. It was again Marie Bonaparte who helped him. He paid it back later when he was safe in London. Mm. Later he said he emigrated because of Anna, his daughter, and to die in freedom.
I think four of his sisters perished in concentration camps.
Right, yeah. At that time, old and ill ladies, yeah. Sigmund Freud and his brother Alexander, they left their sisters a lot of money, but all of them died in concentration camps. So when they wanted to transform this apartment into a museum, Anna, who was in London at that time, wasn't very fond of the idea because Vienna was finished for her. Yeah, because of her aunts and other relatives, yes.
Had a bad taste.
Nobody came back, by the way.
None of the Freuds.
None.
Natasha Mitchell giving you a box seat tour of Dr. Sigmund Freud's home and office of 50 years, now the Sigmund Freud Museum, in the beautiful historic city of Vienna. All in the Mind on ABC Radio National and Radio Australia. Our guide today is Bettina Althoff.
Welcome to Sigmund Freud's practice. Now we are and the apartment number 6, and this was the entrance. All the patients entered through this door.
Obsessive yearning, life is just a bed of neuroses. No wonder I am what I am.
On these chairs sat all the patients, waited for their analysis sessions, but it was never crowded, only one patient waiting here. Yeah. And in this room...
Well, I imagine he probably had some quite famous people as his patients.
Of course he
had. And I don't know that they all would have wanted each other to know that they were seeing him.
Yeah, and also the non-famous, yeah, they wanted to be, it was in the beginning a secret to be patient of Sigmund Freud. Mm. Yeah. So, and there was a secret door in his consulting room, so you could leave the practice by
discreetly.
That door, yes, yeah.
I've read that the waiting room was where the Wednesday gentlemen would gather, cram into each week or month. Remind us of who the Wednesday gentlemen are, because they were incredibly significant in the development of Viennese psychoanalytic culture.
Yeah, it's where he started this Wednesday Evening Society, in the first practice downstairs in 1902. Later it became the Viennese Psychoanalytic Society, but people like Ziggy Jung, Alfred Adler, yeah, they sat on these chairs and they discussed a lot, quarrelled a lot, and smoked a lot.
Well, he smoked an awful lot. In fact, he pretty much chain-smoked cigars, didn't he?
That's right. Here we have an ashtray. It's original, and it was not the only ashtray here, because he used to smoke about 20 cigars a day.
Oh,
how revolting. You can imagine the smell.
You want to kiss him. I can't imagine Martha and he having much of a love life with that sort of stench.
It's horrible, yeah. And he also used to smoke during analysis sessions. Oh. Yeah, times have changed.
And he paid for it in the end, didn't he? He died of horrible cancer.
That's
he had
right.
cancer for years.
Yeah, that's right.
Mouth cancer, face, was awful.
Cancer of the jaw. It was like that. He was a doctor, medicine. He knew what he did. He always tried to give up smoking, but he found out without smoking he could not write. He always wrote, so he always smoked, and that for years. But he had to pay a price for that. He suffered from cancer of the jaw, diagnosed in 1923, something like that, and he had to undergo 31 very painful operations. But he smoked till the bitter end. Yeah.
He seemed to describe it as his, what was it, it was his first addiction. His second addiction was collecting antiquities and art. So we're just turning around now. Mm-hmm. Aha, we have a cabinet full of curiosities and a number of, well, a whole host of little sculptures and figurines from probably the classical, pre-classical eras, which were the things that he loved.
It was very diverse. And Anna gave these items to the museum in 1971. Very precious things amongst them.
So we have a greenish jug with grooved handle, Roman glass, 4th century AD.
And even for him, it was expensive.
Yeah, here we've got a seated cat, Egyptian wood. Wow, that's amazing. Late period, circa 7th to 4th century BC. Egyptian culture really intrigued him, didn't it?
Yeah, but also Mesopotamian, Greek, of course, Chinese. Everything was interesting for him.
Here we have a squatting Silenus with erect penis, Eastern Greece. Terracotta, circa 500 BC.
You must imagine, all these 3,000 or even more items were in these two rooms. Yeah. Now we go into the most important room, maybe the heart of the museum, the consulting room.
Okay, so this is where it all happened. And this was absolutely chock-a-block full of his collection, wasn't it? It wasn't in the rest of the house, but it was very much here.
Yeah, and he used to have this colour.
Red, so we've got red walls, quite a sort of crimson red.
He liked it.
Yeah, well, I can understand why. It's very lush. It's like being in a womb.
Maybe it made people talkative or aggressive, maybe.
Yeah. It's interesting. He was Jewish, but he was atheist, really.
Yeah, that's right.
And yet he collected a lot of sacred imagery and figurines. And what do you think about the symbolism of what he collected? Was it in a way the inspiration behind his development of an understanding about the symbols that occupy our minds?
Maybe. He was very interested in the origins of everything. Yeah, it was the beginning of culture, maybe, and he was very interested in that early parts of human beings.
Civilizational, but also individual.
That's right, yeah. And I think these antiquities are kind of symbol for that period, And he always wanted to understand what moves people.
And what creates them, mm-hmm. what generates them, the sort of layering of a psyche
yeah.
over time.
Exactly. Mm.
There are a lot of erect penises in this collection, I've noticed, which is hardly surprising given that it was Freud. The Wednesday Evening Society.
Yes.
Now, why was that significant? Who were these men?
Not all men.
Oh, right.
No, no. Lou Andrea Salome came here. She was member. Also Sabina Spielrein. Maybe you know the film, A Dangerous Method, by David
Cronenberg. Well, that's just come out this year.
It started here. Yeah, last Friday, the film started. And they also filmed here. So Sabina Spielrein, a patient of Jung, and then a friend, maybe a lover, well, and also...
Well, that's the speculation, isn't it?
Yeah, and the film is about that, yeah. And she also came here and was member of this Wednesday Evening Society.
She was a psychoanalyst as well.
Yeah, so the members changed, yeah. And a lot of friends and also, not only scientists,
doctors,
writers,
and sort of society people and artists.
Yeah.
And
not only doctors. Everybody interested, maybe. He wanted to discuss his theories, ideas with interested people because he was alone with his new ideas.
Famously, though, there was a rift, there was a difference of opinion and a bit of a split in the Wednesday Society, wasn't there?
Of course, yes. They discussed a lot and quarreled a lot. Mm. And many of these friends, for example, Alfred Adler, C.G. Jung, maybe the most famous, yeah, they became enemies. They started as friends and then they became enemies. But not this guy.
We're just looking behind the door here.
Yeah.
Oh, Einstein.
Yeah, that's funny because they only met once, but maybe you know this famous letters, Why War?
Oh, yes.
Einstein wanted Sigmund Freud as a partner to discuss this subject. And Freud came to the conclusion, everything we do for culture is against war. There is no other way.
Dear Mr. Einstein, when I learned of your intention to invite me to a mutual exchange of views upon it, I expected you to choose a problem lying on the borderland of the knowable as it stands today, a theme which each of us, physicist and psychologist, might approach from his own angle. Thus the question which you put to me, what is to be done to rid mankind of the war menace, took me by surprise. And next, I was dumbfounded by the thought of our incompetence, for this struck me as being a matter of practical politics. But then I realized that you did not raise the question in your capacity of scientist or physicist, but as a lover of his fellow men.
And they met in Berlin once, and Freud, he wrote to a friend, it was a very pleasant afternoon because Albert Einstein, he knew as much psychoanalysis as much as I knew about physics, nothing.
Yeah.
There was no quarreling. They remained friends.
And next I reminded myself that I was not being called on to formulate practical proposals, but rather to explain how this question of preventing wars strikes a psychologist.
When they emigrated, he was 4 years old, yeah. And
here he is probably at about that age, or maybe a little bit older.
Yeah, here we see Sigmund Freud with his father Jacob as a schoolboy, and here as a teenager with his mother Amalia.
Looking handsome.
Yeah, yeah. It was the second or even the third marriage of his father Jacob, we don't know.
Oh.
But we know when he was born, Sigmund, yeah, he had already two grown-up half-brothers. Right. One of them had a family, and these circumstances were very complicated for the little boy to understand. He thought, well, my father looks more like a grandfather, and one of my grown-up half-brothers, they would be a suitable husband for my young mother. They had about the same age. Very confusing for him. And Sigmund Freud was one of the first who brought all these reflections into science. It is important for a child, the childhood, my situation in life.
Well, he was obsessed with how our experiences, our imaginings, our dreams, all those things in those first years really influenced our later life.
That's right.
He must possibly read more into it than might be there. He created arguments for and possibilities, but It's always been hard to pin down.
That's right. But I think because he was one of the first, so it was new. Yeah, he was a pioneer.
Yes, in some sense, it doesn't matter if he was right or wrong. It was just the beginning of the discussion.
He opened it.
It must be something psychological. It may be something very physical. That makes me feel the way I do whenever I'm in touch with you.
But he always wanted to work as a scientist. It was not possible for him. He was a Jew, and he wanted to earn money because he wanted to marry this young lady.
Who was Martha?
Here we have Martha, yeah.
Very young Martha.
And they were engaged secretly, but her mother was against Sigmund, an intelligent but poor student, no.
Yes, meanwhile, not a society man.
And they were engaged and separated for 4 long years. During that time, he wrote a lot of love letters, about 1,500, each of them 10 or 15 pages.
But do they still exist?
Yeah.
That's
you
amazing,
can read them, the Pride letters.
It's something psychological.
Here at the Sigmund Freud Museum in Vienna, Jean-Marc Charcot has a presence. He was the great French neurologist who pioneered the use of hypnosis in hysteria, a popular diagnosis or misdiagnosis of the time. Charcot was an early mentor to Freud, but Freud took the treatment of hysteria in a different direction.
And he worked together with his friend, Josef Breuer, was the most important doctor medicine here in Vienna. And this Breuer had a young patient, a resolute, stubborn young lady, and she said...
I like her already.
Yeah, and she said to him, stop and let me talk. That's what he did. And then he found out when she talked about her illness, her symptoms, she felt better and some of the symptoms they even disappeared. And this, for many, many people, is the beginning of psychoanalysis. But this young lady...
The talking cure.
Yes, Anna O.
Anna O. Anna O. Very famous.
Breuer, he called it the cathartic method. Anna O, she called it the talking cure. Yeah. And Freud tried it, and it worked, but when it was very, really interesting, the patient stopped, because they had to talk to a stranger about her secrets, and, well, it was hard for them, and because they felt unwell, and they felt observed, yeah? Mm-hmm. Now we come to the couch. Freud felt that, and he wanted them to take place on this couch in a very relaxed position, and he wanted them to talk about everything that would come into their mind.
So to freely associate, in a way,
right.
Free association.
Right, that's the beginning.
And also for him not to cast a gaze while they talked.
Yeah,
to the couch. Chair was behind the couch.
Yeah. And that worked because they couldn't see Freud. Maybe he slept. Yeah? And so the couch became the symbol of free association.
I wonder if he did sleep.
Sometimes.
I'm sure he might have.
We'll never know.
I am what I am. A mixed up character, an unsolved cryptogram. I act like a lion, but...
Well, thank you for showing me through his early professional life here at his home and workplace, what, for 50 years of his life.
You're welcome, and it was a pleasure.
Well, as I am, they threw me in the sea of life, but I never swam.
Songstress Katie Lee with a cheeky bookend there to our little tour with Bettina Althoff at the Sigmund Freud Museum in Vienna. And the museum celebrates its 40th birthday this year. Lots of extra stuff and info on our website, abc.net.au/rn/allinthemind. And speaking of birthdays, All in the Mind is celebrating its 10 years since I kicked off the show in 2002. Who'd have thunk it? And we'll be bringing you some of the fun from the archives this summer. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Thanks to co-producer Maria Tickle and to Gary Havrillay and Dave Manton. Catch you next week.
The failure of Iraqi democracy would embolden terrorists around the world and extinguish the hopes of millions in the region.
Many Arabs looked at the Iraqi example, or were told by their leaders to look at the Iraqi example, and then asked, is that the kind of, quote, democracy we want?
The attempt to create democracy in Iraq, Rear Vision, and you can download or stream this program from the Radio National website.